46. And it's a real pleasure to be here celebrating 20 years of Sunstone. I've attended most of Sunstone's symposiums from its organization. Today, looks like the ones who are on my panel are choosing to set up there, mainly, I guess, so that we have an audience rather than along here. Today we've been asked to make a presentation on alternative missions, and I would like to thank those who have graciously accepted the invitation to represent various missions of the church. As I say your name, perhaps you could at least stand so people will know whom I'm speaking of. The first person over here is Lewis Leek. And Lewis has been on three different missions, two of them in Spain and one in Singapore. And when he was in Singapore, he also served in India and different places of his mission. Okay, and then there's Cindy Bateman over here. And she was on a welfare mission in Thailand. Thailand. Okay. And then we have Mr. and Mrs. Harmon. Harmon. And they just returned from Africa. There are many different kinds of missions within the church today. Before saying that, though, I feel like I really owe a lot of thanks and gratitude to Dr. Lewis Minch. When I was asked by Sunstone if I would moderate a program of alternate missions, I said I didn't know hardly anyone who would be on a panel with me representing alternate missions. And I called Dr. Lewis Minch, and Dr. Lewis Minch was able to invite Mrs. Bateman and Mr. and Mrs. Harmon. And I did know one person, and that was Lewis Leek. Today there are many alternate missions within the church. The church is a worldwide church. There are many kinds of missions. There are work missions, welfare missions, temple missions, genealogical and family records missions, historical sites missions, information centers missions, leadership missions, administrator of education on a high level in government missions, teaching missions, teaching seminary, teaching grade school, teaching high school, and teaching at the universities. There are medical missions, health missions, and humanitarian service missions. And there are probably others that I haven't thought of. I feel like that the church, being a worldwide church and many different types of missions, that we now have opportunities to serve the church in very meaningful ways in different parts of the world. I will first lead off with my mission. In my case, I served in Romania. And it's what I would like each one of those who are on the panel to do is to tell a little bit about themselves. I've just told you their names, but I want you to know them personally. So I want you to tell about yourself. I want you to tell what was your motivation for going on missions. The Harmons and Leek have served three full-time missions as senior missionaries. And so there's a lot of people who really get the spirit of missionary work, and they go on one mission right after the other. They might remain home for 2 or 3 months, and the next thing you know, they've been called on another mission. And so tell about yourself, what motivated you to go on a mission, and relate your missionary experiences, because I want the people in the audience to know you. In my case, you might say I'm a closet doubter. I've been going to Sunstone now for the last 15 years. When I, you probably wonder what a closet doubter is. But anyway, I'm a person who is somewhat of a skeptic and a questioner, and sometimes I even question some of the fundamental principles of the gospel. At the same time, I love the church. I love the membership of the church. I love the Lord Jesus Christ. I love our Father in heaven. But I do have questions. And in my case, I'm not the type who can get up and say that I know without any shadow of a doubt certain principles of the gospel. So that's what, in a sense, a closet doubter is. It's a person who doubts or who has questions but doesn't share those doubts and questions with others. At the time that I was called to go on a mission, I was serving as a member of the High Council in Evanston, Wyoming. I had attended a marriage of my daughter in the Salt Lake Temple. And when I left the temple and we're out on the temple grounds, our stake president came to me and he asked, he says, "Charlie, I would like you to think of going on a mission." And I said, "No way, Jose." I just had no interest whatsoever of going on a mission. And yet I had served as a missionary many years before in the West Central States Mission. And I loved my mission. But as years went on and college background and so forth, I began to question many of the fundamentals of the church. And so I had no desire to go on a mission. And yet I've always been active in the church, as Brother Lee can testify to. So he asked if I'd go, and I told him no way. And then he says, "You know, I'm not speaking to you as your friend, but I'm speaking to you as your stake president." He says, "And you just now left the temple, and in the temple you made some covenants with your Father in heaven." And he says, "And one of the covenants that you made with your Father in heaven is that you'd be willing to give of your time and your talent in your means to building up of the kingdom of God. Does that mean anything to you?" And I said, "Yes, it definitely has meaning." He says, "Then at least think of going on a mission." My wife wanted to go on a mission in the worst way, and she'd been talking to me about it for years, and I kept saying, "No, no, no." Well, finally, as I was thinking of this, there was a member of our Bishop Rick in Evanston, and his father was in the Philippines as a mission president. And he asked my wife and I, he says, "Would you think of going to the Philippines on a mission?" He says, "My father's a mission president, and he's looking for senior missionaries." And I told him, I says, "Well, I would like to, but I don't want to go on a proselyting mission." And he said, "Well, I don't think you have to proselyte." He says, "You can be serve in a leadership position, and you can be a supportive kind of missionary. Or if you wish to teach school, you can even teach school in the Philippines if you so desire." He says, "So the kind of mission in which you wish to go on is up to you." Well, the mission president in the Philippines wrote into the missionary department in Salt Lake, and he told them that I was willing to go on a mission, but that I didn't want to go on a proselyting mission. And he told them somewhat of my background. In my case, I'm a psychologist and also a special educator. And so they, when they got the letter from him, they called my stake president and says, "Will you ask Elder Bride if you'd be willing to go to Romania on a mission by February 17th? And I said that I would be glad to go on a mission, but not at that time because I was a school counselor and needed to finish out the school year. And so then during August at this time of the year, then I talked to some of the people about going on a mission here at Sunstone, because I was still conflicted within as to what to do. And Dr. Minch, of course, is one of those individuals, and two or three others, and they encouraged me to think seriously of going on a mission, that they felt like I could render a service to our Father in Heaven if I would accept a mission, even though I may have some questions. And so then in April, here's a whole year later, we put in our papers to go on a mission to Romania. But when I received my call, it said proselyting mission with additional assignments. And this was upsetting to me to no end. And I wrote into the missionary committee and told them that I didn't want to go on a proselyting mission, that I had consented that I'd go on a humanitarian service mission. But they never did answer my letter. They just left me to stew. And then finally I called Ike Ferguson, whom I'd talked to two or three times in between, and asked him if our calling had been changed. And he says, no, you're still going to Romania as to and on a humanitarian service mission. And he said, I don't want you to worry about the call that you have. He says, because that was just on a standard form. He says, it has nothing to do with the kind of mission you're going on. And we reported to the Missionary Training Center on the 13th of July, and we were to learn Romanian. But I had a very hard time trying to learn the language. And then after 2 months, then we were shipped to Romania, and we spent 14 months in Romania on our mission. We were engaged mostly in providing in-service education. In-service education to, like, orphanages, to psychomotor rehabilitation centers, to a research center. We taught some classes at the University of Bucharest. We also worked in a mental hospital. A humanitarian service mission, missionary, pretty well creates, again, their own kind of mission and what they want to do. It's true that you work in a committee, like we had a project director, and we'd tell them what we wanted to do, and we'd discuss it, and then we'd have to write it up, and then we'd have to send it into Germany for to be accepted. But it takes an awful long time. One of the discouraging parts of our mission is it takes a long time for them to approve of a project. Well, your mission might be just about over with before you get any approval. And so we had what we called approved projects and non-approved projects. And we justified our non-approved projects by saying, it says in the scripture to be anxiously engaged in a good cause. And it was the very projects that we were working in that would eventually wind up being approved. But that is one of the discouraging parts of, and from the shake of heads, I can see that must be some of the discouraging parts of other missions as well. In our in-service education, the kinds of things in which we talked about, in my case, is we'd talk about understanding human behavior from a perceptual point of view. And the basic premise of perceptual psychology is that all behavior, without exception, is the result of how we perceive the world at any given moment in time. That we don't behave in terms of others' perceptions, but our own perceptions. We would talk about the seven determiners of perception. For example, the physical organism as a determiner. The person who is born blind perceives the world differently than the person who has sight. Opportunity is a determiner of perception, or the culture in which we're raised. We, in America, of course, behave as Americans. In Romania, you behave as a Romanian. And there are definitely some cultural differences. We would talk about time as being a determiner of perception. We talk about the self-concept, what you think of yourself. The person who has a positive self-concept, who feels that he's liked, wanted, and worthy, perceives very differently and behaves differently than the person who perceives themselves as not liked, not wanted, and not able. We would talk about goals and values as being determiners of perception. And we'd also talk about the availability of the perceptual field as being a determiner of perception. And so we'd kind of lay the groundwork as to why people behave the way that they do. Perceptual psychology is a good way of understanding individual behavior. Behavioral psychology is a good way of understanding group behavior. We would then also talk about things like creating safe, trusting relationships. creating a safe, trusting relationship through reflective listening, by being assertive, by harnessing harmful behaviors. We'd also talk about problem solving. Somehow, these kinds of lectures and discussions held at these various places that I mentioned made the people feel freer, had more control over their own lives. They were able to talk to each other and to problem solve. And it helped them to create what we call win-win situations. And so these are the kinds of things that we did. In Romania also, I was able to translate Bill's Index of Adjustment and Values, a self-concept test, into Romanian. It measures self-concept, self-acceptance, ideal self, and personal adjustment. It's being standardized for Romania. The people of Romania as a whole are definitely more depressed than the people here in the United States. The people in Romania, the average person, the average psychiatrist, makes $40 a month. Our psychiatrists here make probably a little more than $40 an hour. So there are very poor people. The people were loving, understanding, acceptant, and very tolerant, and definitely wanted to learn. At the same time, in Romania, the people are not a close-knit people. Each person kind of does his or her own thing. They don't really talk to each other. And if you went to the mental hospital where they had 3,000 patients and you ask if there's an adolescent treatment unit, a lot of the other people at the hospital who had worked there for years had no idea if they had an adolescent treatment unit, yet they did with 100 children. That they just don't work, there's no networking. And they're definitely reinventing the wheel over and over again. My wife and I, we feel like our lives would not have been as complete or as whole if we hadn't have gone on our mission to Romania. One of the things that we've been able to start since coming home is the Romanian Association of Humanistic and Analytic Psychology. I wrote to the Humanistic Psychological Association in San Francisco and asked them if I could get a hold of, if they'd let me know the price of their past journals, as that I'd like to purchase them eventually for Romania. And I was willing to do this on my own. And they wrote back to me and says, "We will send all past issues free of charge as long as you pay for the shipping." It cost me $85. It cost them $3,080 to send these journals to Romania. And so in this way, we're trying to extend our services in terms of mental health and research and counseling. To be true to our time here, I think that I will close, but I'm going to have Louis Leek, who will also present for about 15 minutes, and then after Louis Leek, then we'll go to Cindy Bateman, and then we'll turn the rest of the time over to the Harmons, although hopefully we have around 10 minutes at the end to where we can answer any individual questions. Or on the other hand, if you have your own personal experiences and you've been missionaries, you can come up here and tell us about them. So, Louis Leek, okay?
I'm happy to join Charlie in sharing experiences. And I'm a convert to the church and never served a mission when I was young. And my wife and I always looked forward to doing so, and I finally decided to retire, and we would serve the mission, and we enjoyed it so much, although it isn't a bed of roses. But overall, we enjoyed it so much that we decided to keep going and still hope to go on at least one more mission. We served in the Singapore mission first, with service in India, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore. and always speaking English, except that we had to learn a little bit of some of the other languages. But because of bad experiences in India, the brethren decided that we better teach in English so the couples who are the backbone of the work in India could understand what the locals were teaching, because we learned that they were not teaching what they were being taught in English, and using their position for personal aggrandizement in some cases. So our callings have been in leadership and member work, and by far the majority of our work has been with the leaders. I remember, I'll just quickly cover a few items. For example, in Bangalore, India, I had the experience of doing as I'd tried to do elsewhere and teaching the branch presidency in Bangalore about some of the principles of leadership. Everywhere we've been, the leaders are very young in the church, sometimes quite young otherwise. And it was quite rewarding in that the first counselor especially was very, very prompting and very interested, and would tell me how each week he was applying the principles I was teaching in his job. In his daily work. And he ended up being the branch president there. Later I served as a counselor for a year in the Canary Islands in Spain to a man named Artiles. He was fairly new in the church and very unsure of himself. And at first, it was very interesting to observe the meetings of the presidency and the council. He had no agenda, didn't know anything about organizing, and I observed and then started writing handwritten notes of the things I thought would be well to cover, and that gradually grew to where I was preparing the agenda for the meetings and gradually teaching him and the council members the people just have no experience in many of them, and so the most simple things that we would take for granted needed attention. I won't try to cover by any means all. In our last mission, we served in the Barcelona mission of Spain. I remember so vividly some experiences in Valencia. The young district president, under whom I served for almost a year as a counselor, is a very sharp young man, and is able to translate principles into practice very well, but still has no background in church leadership and didn't know about the simple things of preparing an agenda for a meeting. So I did the same thing there that I had done in the Canary Islands, and never tried to tell them what to do, but just at the best I could show by example, by starting to present my ideas in writing, and gradually got to where I was helping them to try to schedule meetings and so people would know what was coming and not just talk about whatever came to their mind in the time of the meeting. And they really didn't understand what the purpose of the meetings, of the presidency and council type meetings, were. As usual, there are personal differences. There was a branch president that I was trying to work with as a member of the district presidency, trying to help. I had four branch presidents under my wing, so to speak, to try to help them. And one of them was especially resistant to learning. He had been a member of a branch presidency, starting about 17 years ago, as I recall. The mission, the church began, church work, that is missionary work, began in Valencia about 21 years ago, as I recall. He was one of the early converts and an early branch president, so he didn't have much to learn. And yet, if he had been a little more open, it could have helped him a lot to learn some of the principles of leadership. In our last assignment, we were in the island of Mallorca in the Mediterranean, about a half-hour flight from Valencia, and had a joyful experience in working with a branch of about 300 members there. They have very little contact from other leaders except the mission president, who gets there occasionally because he has to go out and interview missionaries. And he's very, our mission president, President Hawes, was excellent in also trying to give leadership to the local leaders, district presidencies, and in this case, a branch president. It was a real privilege to work with the President Diaz in Palma de Mallorca. He had been a leader in the church for most of his 10 years as a member, and yet also didn't understand an awful lot, including what the purpose of presidency meetings was, and had not ever delegated any responsibilities to his counselors, and wondered why his counselors didn't come to the meetings of the presidency, and simple little things like that I was able to help him in. And he, when he learned a little bit about what we had done in the Canary Islands, he just became extremely eager for us to give firesides every other Sunday, and we gave Saturday training sessions to leaders and a lot of things. And as we left, I was too busy at the port, about ready to board the ferry, talking to other people, and he gave my wife one of his first paintings with tears in his eyes because of the feelings that he had toward us. And we've had the reciprocal feelings with him and many others, which is part of the real joy of missionary work, of course. I think I won't talk more about leadership training, although there was tremendously more to it than I've covered, obviously. I guess I might tell you about my background a little. I just remembered I hadn't said some things. I'm an engineer by training. I ended up in defense studies for the last 20 years or 25 years of my career. In the last 9 years, I was studying how the Soviet Union, or how Soviet leaders thought and how they reacted to what we did and so forth to advise defense leaders. And I've had many callings in the church and have had great joy and much service, and just had no doubt that I wanted to serve a mission when the time came. My wife also. But it turned out we hadn't made very good plans in that direction and had built a house that was totally infeasible to leave and ended up selling it. It was supposed to have been our retirement house. That was in Colorado. One of the things that we did, Charlie didn't mention the words, but he has taught a lot of the love-trust model in Romania and followed the work of C.K. Allen. We also had the privilege of learning much from C.K. Allen and his son Roger. And one of the things that I have done in each mission is try to teach leaders and the people how to apply the principles of the gospel in being a little more gentle with each other. And in these other cultures, that's especially relevant. Everyone here is not especially gentle, but as a rule, I observe that Americans are more gentle with each other than Spaniards or Indians or people where we've served. And so we taught the love trust model quite a lot in firesides and training sessions. And I just remember one occasion in Malaysia, we had taught three firesides on the topic, and I had used role plays that were somewhat canned. That is, we set up the situation. Toward the end of the last one, I said, "Now I don't want you to think that this only applies to the situations that I've already figured out how to respond to. And I want you to just give me any kind of problem you want to and see if we can do any good with it." And it turned out that after a little thought, that a young man who wanted to serve a mission said, "Well, I'd like to have you tell me how I can talk to my father about serving mission. He's an old Chinese Chinaman, and there's no way he's going to let me serve a mission. And I'm afraid he'll cut off my head if I talk to him about it." Well, I ended up role-playing the part of the son with an older Chinese gentleman playing the part of the father. And I won't go through the details, but just by talking to him in a reasonable way that many of us would talk to another, I ended up finding out what this man interpreted to be the real concern of the father, and it was whether the son would follow his obligation to the father in the long run of taking care of him after going on a mission. And after finding out that that was his principal concern, I assured him that I certainly would do that, acting the role of the son and so forth. It was interesting that he went home and at the end he and others said, "Oh, you don't have to yell at people, huh?" So he went home and he talked to his father somewhat in the vein that I had role-played, and then ended up that his father responded exactly the way this other man had responded, and he went on a mission and ended up being a very fine missionary in the Singapore mission. What do I have? About it? Okay. I'll just say that it's a tremendous privilege to serve the Lord, and when we come home, we feel like they don't really need us very much here, so we're eager to go serve again after we take care of things with our family. It's a privilege to talk to you on this occasion.
See over the podium. My name's Cindy Bateman, and I'm a physician here in Salt Lake City. I'm a general internist. I'm from Provo, and I'd like to share with you two mission experiences. One was my own, and the second is the experience of my parents. And I want to start with their experience, even though theirs came second. I feel partly responsible for their experience. I'll just tell you a little bit about what got them going on a mission. They're on their third mission right now. They left 2 weeks ago to go to Hawaii. When I was in medical school, 1984, 85, I'm not sure exactly when this happened, my father became very ill. He had a ruptured aneurysm in his brain, which wasn't diagnosed right away. And while they were making the diagnosis, they were doing an angiogram, and he had a stroke because of the complications of this bleed and also from the angiogram. And then while he was in the ICU, semi-conscious with a catheter in, he developed an infection in his bladder that went into his brain, and he developed a brain infection that causes brain to swell. And it was about this time that I came back from, jumped on a plane from Baltimore and came back to Salt Lake to see my father. And as I got there, the day after we arrived, he started having a seizure, and he was developing brain swelling so severe that he was about to die. He was about to herniate his brain. I don't know if you know much about medicine, but there's only so much room for your brain in your skull, and his was coming out because it was so swollen. And there was an emergency procedure. My brother's also a doctor. All my family was there, and we all did a lot of quick thinking and quick praying and, you know, lots of things, and the surgeons drilled a hole in his brain, and he got on antibiotics. And during that time, I went in at a time when none of my family was there, and I gave my father a blessing, not assuming any special authority or anything. It was just me and him and God, and I promised that he and my mother would go on a mission, which they hadn't, they kind of thought about. My dad was kind of dragging his feet. He hadn't gone on a mission when he was younger and wasn't quite sure if he was cut out for that. Well, he recovered completely from this illness, and I found out later that not only did I promise that, but my mother promised that, and all my brothers and sisters in separate little promises made those same promises. My parents went to Sydney, Australia on a public relations mission, and he's done, this was quite a while ago, I mean, some 10 years ago now. Anyway, their second mission, they were called to go to Hanoi, Vietnam, a communist country that's not open to visitors much. And this was just last year. They got home just before Christmas. Very unusual and probably unrepeatable, not unrepeatable in the sense of talking about it, but in the sense probably won't happen again in the same way, mission for the church. Through some doctors in Salt Lake City who are members of Project SMILE, which is a national organization of ear, nose, and throat doctors and dentists, the church donated a surgical microscope to the doctors at the main military hospital in Hanoi after some exchanges with those doctors doing surgery and exchanging information. And they asked, the church asked, after giving that microscope, is there something else we can do to help you in Hanoi? Of course, the church is not allowed in Hanoi officially. And they said, sure, we need some English teachers to help our doctors and our professionals. So my parents and another couple, the same couple that they'd been in Australia with, actually the Stedmans, at the same time, went to Hanoi, never knowing what they were getting into, and spent a year doing the most incredible non-proselyting humanitarian teaching work in Hanoi. And I had the opportunity to go spend several weeks with them last September. So I know firsthand about the experience they had. They were teaching at the main military hospital in the city, which was several blocks from the Hanoi Hilton. You heard of that? A big prison in the center of Hanoi, which we walked around several times when we were there. Hanoi is a place, at least last year, I think it's already changed by eons, that was almost untouched by technology. The buildings were still the same buildings and the same paint that went up when the French influence were in North Vietnam, long before the war. There were computers and TVs in the shops, and no trucks or buses on the roads, mainly bicycles, motorcycles, and cycle-driven Ciclos, three-wheeled vehicles. They had just bought a fleet of taxis in Hanoi just before we came, red taxis. They were all brand new. And I think I must have seen five buses in the entire time I was there. Such a poor country. It's exploding with input from other countries. So they went to this teaching hospital, to a military hospital, and they had a class full of doctors who were the top military doctors in the capital city of Vietnam. And I taught their class on a couple of occasions when I went, and on the front row was the chief physician to the president of the president of the country in Vietnam. Wonderful people, wonderful influence. And the other people they taught were the children of all these VIP leaders and doctors and scientists in Hanoi. So they had a chance to teach those gifted, or at least richer and entitled children in Hanoi, and also these doctors. And mostly they taught English, but they also had an opportunity to meet many wonderful people and make many friends. I think they worked themselves to the bone, and they sort of crawled home on all fours by the time they were done in that heat. All of them lost 20 or 30 pounds while they were there, and they all their cholesterols went down into the normal range. And it was a wonderful experience. And it has opened up other doors, although things are still pretty tight. And there are other couples there now who have followed in their path, although they were unable to get younger missionaries in to do the same kind of work. The other thing I wanted to tell you about was my mission experience. When I was finishing college, I couldn't decide what I wanted to do. And I actually, not that it matters, it's just that it was one of my most embarrassing moments, but I gave the graduation speech in my college, and after the speech, the president of the university at BYU came up and asked me what I was going to do with my life, and I said, well, I'm not sure yet. Wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, and I'd actually put my mission papers in, but I hadn't gotten them yet. I didn't want to tell my family. I was a surprise for them, and I didn't want to just bring it up there in the middle of this graduation ceremony. But I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so I went on a mission, and I put in my papers as a regular missionary. But after I put my papers in, decided that I really wanted an unusual mission. So I ordered it in other ways, did some quick talking with the Lord and other kinds of means. But my mission call came to be a welfare services missionary in Hong Kong, and I spent 2 months learning Cantonese, and then in the MTC, and then I went to Hong Kong, and I was in Hong Kong 2 months before a special project came up. In 1979, there was a lot of turmoil in Southeast Asia. About the time that Pol Pot's regime fell in Cambodia, and the North Vietnamese invaded and took over, there was a lot of chaos, and there was a huge number of refugees that fled to the Thai border. Of course, there were other Vietnamese refugees and Laotian refugees, but there was almost an insurmountable problem with refugees. And so the church was working on ways to help this problem. And Elder Marindy Hanks was executive administrator in Hong Kong. And one missionary couple spent their entire mission writing and submitting proposals to the United Nations to have the church go in and teach and help with the refugee program. They did some other little things, but that was their main assignment, and they spent their whole mission doing that. On the tail end of that, a second couple came, and about this time, the church was accepted to work as teachers in refugee camps in Thailand. And that was about the time I ended up in Hong Kong. And Elder Hanks went to different missions in Thailand, and I'm sorry, in Southeast Asia, to the Philippines, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea, all the missions within that area, and he selected missionaries, sister missionaries, who had some teaching credentials. The director of our new program called Welfare Services Unit for Refugees in Thailand was had a PhD in education. She directed a group of 10 teachers. We were all teaching certified or had other degrees, and we designed a program to teach Vietnamese, Cambodian, Laotian refugees how to resettle in the United States. They were all people who had escaped, couldn't go back, couldn't go forward, and they were applying for resettlement or coming to live in this country. So we worked under the auspices of the United Nations and with the Thai government to prepare, invent, teach, come up with this program and teach the 15,000 refugees that were at any one point in this refugee camp in Thailand. Wonderful experience. One of the agreements was that the missionaries who went in to this camp would not proselyte in any way. And that was a promise that Elder Hanks made to the United Nations and to the Thai government. So we worked very hard. We didn't wear traditional missionary clothes. We didn't wear traditional missionary name tags. We didn't put elder and sister. No elders. We didn't put sister on our name tags. The reason was they all thought we were Catholic nuns when we had sister on, particularly the Vietnamese who had some Catholic background. And we were all teachers and walked in a dusty refugee camp with barbed wire fences around it, teaching English, but mostly survival skills for human beings who had nothing left and who were going to settle in a new and unfriendly country to them. Cultural differences are so overwhelmingly difficult, especially from Asia to Western culture. And we learned a lot about it, they learned a lot about it, and we were sort of a buffer for them before they jumped into life in the United States or Canada. Almost everybody in our group later went on to humanitarian-based careers. It really was a turning point for me. I decided to go to medical school, something I had thought about but wasn't sure I wanted to do. Other women in our group became social workers. One has a PhD in international education. Another one teaches English as a second language in Hawaii at BYU Hawaii. And each one has a story. One worked in rape crisis and other things down in St. George and set up a whole sort of a shelter there. And I can just tell you that experience of working human to human with people in great need was the most incredible and life-changing experience for every woman who worked in the group. maybe that's all I'll say. I just wanted to add one more thing, and that is that this became a family tradition after I did this. My whole family became involved in service and helping. We've always worked with people of other cultures and worked with students from other countries, but never much with Asia. And that kind of opened many doors for my family, and I think my parents sponsored almost 30 refugees, Cambodians. They all kind of came, drizzled in from one family, but worked very hard and got to know Vietnamese families. It led to their going on this mission to Vietnam and having the courage to go to a place like Hanoi, otherwise that they might have been frightened about. My nephew, my sister's son, was just ready to go on a mission and was a little uncomfortable going on a proselyting mission, but very much wanted to go on a service mission. He petitioned through every avenue he could think of. I talked to people I knew, and my parents talked to people they knew, and they went to the missionary department, and they wrote letters, and he talked to his bishop and his stake president, but they all said no. So he had a hard decision, and he finally decided to go, and he just went to Brazil. But I'll leave you with the counsel that Elder Hanks gave me to give him, and that is, it doesn't matter where you go, because you can always find a way to do service in the way that you want to do it, in a way that it's needed where you go. Thank you.
I would like to have just sat there and listened to the rest of you. It would have probably been a better thing to do. When I came home from my mission 3 months ago and reported in my ward, I started out with, I know I haven't died and gone to heaven, but how come I feel like I've already endured to the end? And this was going on constantly, and you'll have to forgive my right hand. It's been on automatic pilot for a year and a half. And fortunately, it's not as hot up here as it was in the pulpit in our ward, so I won't have to do that. But when one thinks of going on a mission, you know you're going to do what they tell you, quote. We were called to serve in Africa because some dear friends of ours were the mission president. And he was petrified and didn't know what he was doing. And his wife was my very dear friend. And so they recruited us because they knew we wouldn't know what we were doing. And we'd all learn together. And there's a danger to that. But nonetheless, my husband, having served a mission in France, was all game because we were going to a French-speaking mission. So he got there and he thought he'd died and gone to heaven. And I got there and I thought I just died, not only with the heat but with the language. Second of all, I was petrified of black people. I had never been around them. I don't think I had looked in one black face in my life. I was raised in Canada, and there were none in our community. And so I had to quickly rethink this thing. Either I'm going to be terrified for a year and a half and be very ineffective and not get to know these people, much less love them, or I must make some changes in my philosophy. And it was the easiest thing I ever did. There was no office. We had our office in the dining room of the mission president. And there was a table and 8 chairs and 2 desks. And I was promised an IBM computer, IBM typewriter, and least of all, a desk. But there was nothing for me, nothing at all. And when the president and his wife would eat dinner, here are all these black natives standing around all hungry, saying, "Bon appetit! Bon appetit!" And it was really rather amusing. But in due time, we improved upon that situation. We moved the president out of this building into a, quote, mission home. And the office started to take shape. Well, that was a challenge for about 3 months. And it was difficult, but we made it. But after 3 months, I thought, there's not enough here for me. I have got to find some other way to feel fulfilled or feel that I'm important to this mission. Having filled two others, I was acquainted with what I should have been doing, and this was not nearly satisfying enough. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with an office mission. If you love office work that much, maybe that'll be enough for you. But it wasn't enough for me. I've been in office all my life. So we began to look for alternate ways of reaching out to these wonderful people. And it was so easy because the minute they walked in the office, they wanted to know what we were about. The church, we were the first missionaries in there after the mission president. So any members who came in were months old in the church, very few, more than a year. And, of course, all the traffic that came in and out, 90% was probably, 50% anyway, were not members of the church. And they were electricians and plumbers and painters, and we needed it all. They just came. And in no time, they were asking what we were about. Will you teach me? And, of course, we started out with 18 missionaries, so it didn't take long to keep them busy. But the ripple effect takes over, and they want their families to know about it. They want their brothers and sisters, and they want their companions. And it's just the ultimate in proselyting experience to be in Africa. I will tell you about a couple. First of all, the electrician, we found out through a great number of disasters that the amount of cycles, you can tell I'm good on electricity. What is it? 60 cycles and 50 cycles.
50 cycles.
Okay, they're on 50 cycles, and we're on 60 cycles. So all the appliances that we plugged in went just in smoke. And it took a long time to figure that out because even the electricians there didn't understand what the difference was. So needless to say, we had a live-in electrician for about 6 months. In that time, it was very expensive. I mean, but we were also ignorant of the problem that it just was one of those necessary evils. But he was a young man, about 35, and good-looking, and smoked heavily, and my French, you know, it was not what it should have been, and needless to say, I don't think the MTC improved it one whit, but we had a private tutor there, and my comprehension improved considerably, and I tell people that I understood a lot more than I could speak, but I think that I didn't send anyone to the bathroom who didn't already want to go. So that's the only claim to speaking French that I really can tell you about. But anyway, Kwame started being so interested in the church, and the first thing, we had the library books in our apartment, and he picks up Jesus the Christ. And, you know, that's kind of heavy even for us old-timers. And he said, I would like to buy it. And so we didn't think he had enough money, but he said, when I get through with, yes, he would have enough money when he got through with our problems, I promise. So I knew he was a good risk. So I gave him a book, and two or three weeks later, he's just excited about this book, and he starts to look so much lighter. I don't mean less black, I mean brighter from his face. And about the third week, I said, Kwame, when are you going to join the church? And he said, I've had my third lesson. Well, I was so excited I could hardly stand it. Well, that man joined the church and is one of the most beautiful members. He is the activity director in his branch. And he comes in and he just lights up a room. He is so full of the Spirit and so thrilled with what he has found. And this is true with all the members. But I'm only going to have time to just barely hit this subject. Sam was our first convert. And Sam was a Liberian refugee. He's a school teacher, having been a principal for 14 years, and all of a sudden he finds himself a refugee, unable to get any employment because he is not a native Ivorian. Now, the unemployment situation there is dreadful without any influx of people. 80% of the people are unemployed, so this brings in countless problems that you can't understand here. But he was just barely eking out an existence. But we found out that he was a tailor also. And our prayer in going to any of our missions was that we might make a difference in the life of one of God's children, at least one. In Africa, and as our particular calling was, there is not opportunity to do anything on any grand scale. But maybe the most important thing is this one-on-one. If you can see that you have changed the life of one person and improved it, that is very satisfying. And we didn't have a lot of money to invest in anybody. The hole is bottomless in Africa. But one-on-one, we can do little things. Well, we happen to be getting 22 new missionaries, local elders, and the church has to support them from the wonderful missionary funds. They are given 5 pairs of pants, 6 shirts, 5 pairs of socks, 6 ties, and a foam mattress to sleep on, and an umbrella and a suitcase, all bought with the church funds. So our mind started to germinate, what can we do for Sam? So we secured a little treadle Singer sewing machine, and Sam was in business. And he thought he had died and gone to heaven. It was a very small outlay of cash, but it made the difference in that man's whole life from here on out. He is self-sustaining. He is the tailor for the mission. He made 88 pairs of pants while I was there. And I understand he has an order for that many more right now. He now, of course, is a member of the church. He has brought in at least 18 people that are directly related in association. His wife is a beautiful girl, and undoubtedly her family will be contacted by the missionaries. That made a great deal of difference in that man's life. Also, there are peculiar regulations having to do with employment and schooling, which you can't, even though you've gone to school 4 years, you must pay a huge fee to write the final examinations. They don't have that money. There's no way they can make that money. And so here they arrive at the point of graduation, and it's being withheld. Say for $150, that would cover all of their examinations, but it might as well be $1,050. They don't have a dime. The same thing with employment. To apply for a job, you've got to put up $35 with your application. That's no guarantee that you get the job. If you don't get the job, tough beans. That's just the way it is. And so they come to the church for help. And, of course, the funds of the church are not for that purpose. But there's always some soft-hearted, soft-headed missionary around who will help. And many, many times they come in and they say, I haven't eaten for 4 days. That really got to me. And so someone eats this day. These are things that I shall never forget. Never. And when she said they lose weight in these countries where it's so hot and on the equator, doggone, it never happened to me. And I really felt cheated in that regard. But that was minor compared to the wonderful things that did happen there. There was one young man who had waited 2.5 years to get his into the doctoral program. He had his master's degree. He had waited 2.5 years and finally was accepted in the University of Abidjan, and came, and his father was supposed to send it to him from Cameroon, and his father just didn't have it, and it was not there. And he said, then my life is over. My life is over. I mean, what can one do? So another couple and the Hormans got their heads together, and we made it happen. And to see that man's face anytime, you can see him clear over in the corner there. He is smiling clear over here, and when we meet him, it is such a wonderful feeling to have him embrace us and thank us for what we have helped him do. I also taught in the literacy program, and that was a great joy. Am I over time? Okay. I found that the African people in Abidjan are all literate in French, and they are very excited to learn English. Even the young children all know French very, very well and read and write. And it was a joy to teach them English. Our class got so big we had to divide it. We had a young group and an older group. And from that small nucleus, we had 4 baptisms. And I'm sure there will be more. And there is nothing that you can do for these people who have so little that will be unappreciated. You see, first of all, their life is hopeless because there is nothing to look forward to. They're going to live and die just like their parents did. There's nothing to look forward to. They have no identity. They are just mortals on that planet. And when the gospel comes into their lives, they gain an identity. And the plan teaches that they are important in the plan of God, in God's plan, that they are children of God, that they're of worth, and that we're all brothers and sisters. Can you imagine what an ennobling concept that is to someone who's never heard that? That is just beautiful. And all of a sudden, their lives change. They don't have any more money in their pockets. They don't have anything physically change except the expression on their face and the light in their eyes. And it's just the most wonderful thing in the world. And I must say that it happened very quickly that we stopped seeing black and white. We stopped seeing color entirely. And that's a wonderful day. And I personally feel that there are no color lines in the church. We're all children of God. And he looks upon us with his spiritual eyes. And spirit is light. And as we are filled with his spirit, we are all light. And we are all loved. And we are all very important to him. And I am happy to be with you. And I appreciate this opportunity to meet you wonderful people.
I planned on her speaking the whole time, but I'm glad to take a few minutes. But she was rather conservative. She didn't hold up this book, and I think I'll take advantage of it. I thought that all my life, what a wonderful experience it would be to go to Africa and find out, is it really true in Africa? Some of these stories that I hear, is it really that kind of a place? Well, I found out that we had a lot of firsthand experiences you'd never believe. And she didn't even believe me when I told her some of them, because they were in French and I translated them back. But anyway, she started collecting these stories, and this book is at the printers right now, and it will be available in the Deseret Book and the ZCMI and all these stores as soon as it gets out of the printers. And so if you're interested in knowing it, and the reason we wrote it is not for money, because that's not the purpose at all. The purpose is to teach people, what is Africa really like? If you're a missionary and you want to go over there, how do you prepare for it? What will you really run into it? There is nothing available presently that describes this properly. But those are the reasons that I wanted to go to Africa, and I did find it different. I was in the office, but I had a couple of other jobs. One of them was to teach everybody, organization, and so forth, just like everybody else, leadership. And I'll tell you, if you want to have an experience with leadership, try that one. I was over the whole Abidjan area, and there were six or eight branch presidents, and I had to meet with them and teach them. And I'll give you just one typical example. I was talking to the some of the high council members, and one of them says, "You know, I've been a high councilman now for 4 months, and I go to church. How come that's all I do?" So I had to start right to be with the basics with all of them and teach them, what does a high council member do? What does the branch president do? What does the state president, district president do, and everything? And we had wild stories, one after another, of how these people talked and how it tell things and how they'd be reversed, and everything went backwards, and it just, these are in the book, these stories. But one other thing that I ran into, like her, I thought, I don't want to just sit in the office all day. And at night, he didn't want to get out too much. So we came up with an idea, and she related the electrician would come in, would talk to him, baptize him. The plumber would come in and talk to him, baptize him. And this would go on and on and on. And we had a real problem of all these people being baptized without the leadership behind them. And so they put a put us on notice we could only baptize so many a month. So we had them lined up 2 and 3 months ahead of time, waiting their turn so that we could baptize them. I'll give you an example. One person that came in, his name was Paul, and we baptized him, and after the third lesson, he said, I think you better skip a week. And so he came back a week and says, I got rid of the problem, I divorced her. They were so devoted that they would go to any extent. And I said, well, you didn't have to divorce her. He says, I did, because the church does not take polygamy at the time. And I was in polygamy, so I came back to one wife that I felt that I really had to have, and corrected my life, and I've corrected everything that you've said so I can be baptized. This church is true. And they do that. They go overboard in every respect. Well, after he was baptized, then his wife was baptized, and then just as we left, they invited us back, and they said, I'd like you to baptize the rest of our family now. We went over and met her parents and their family, and they said, the life has changed so much with these two people. We can tell that we want this kind of a life. We want to be happy like they are. We want to have this feeling of strength. We want to have this wonderful, whatever it is that you have. Can't we have it? We want to be baptized. And I said, well, I've got to teach you first. How many of them are you to be baptized? 30. Well, this is just a common experience that it would happen over and over again in different areas. And another time, I met a preacher. And he says, look, I am a self-made preacher. I need your church to fortify me up so I can teach my congregation. He says, look, I have a congregation of 300 people. I have an organ. I have a chapel. I need a church like yours to teach them. He says, will you please baptize us and integrate us into your church? Well, I had to turn him down because the fact that he lived more than 2 miles away. We were told don't baptize anybody more than 2 kilometers away because we don't have the leadership for it. And he couldn't believe it, that I couldn't baptize him and his congregation. And he didn't want to stay as the preacher. He said, I'll take any position that you want to give me. And he says, just teach. We're eager for the church. At another occasion, I knew I had to get in the tribal area and go back and see the tribes, and so I did. And we had all these experiences, and I talked in the tribal area. At one time, I went into a tribe, and and this is just typical of any other times, he looked at me and says, "We have two members that are that you're teaching." He says, "I hear these reports about your church, how it changes their lives, how they become wonderful people. I need this in my tribe." He says, "Please, will you baptize everybody in my church, in my tribe?" And he said, "Out here is space. I'll give you the space. I'll give you the land. You can build your chapel on it. I'll help you build it. I'll give you labor. I'll give you what materials we can. We're humble people. But build a church out here and baptize, because I want a happy tribe, just like the influence that you're teaching, how these people are coming." And I said, "This sounds very interesting." I said, "But how many people are there in your tribe?" 16,000. And I said, "Well, now, wait a minute. You want me to baptize 16,000 people and have them meet here in this chapel that you want me to build here?" He says, "Yes." I said, "You know, that's kind of a chore." I said, "How am I and my wife going to teach 16,000 people?" And he said, "If you have the truth, if what you are teaching me, teaching these people is true," he says, "you should have the answers. We want the truth. We want to live this high standard and life that you have to offer. Do it." So I talked to him and I says, "Look, here's the answer. We have two people that are coming to our church right now in Abidjan. And you can understand how physically impossible it is for me to teach 16,000 people in the amount of time that we're only here, a year and a half. So have these two people continue. And let them come to church and let them set up the example. We need leadership. We'll teach them to be leaders. And if they are of the caliber that you're telling us, these two people can become formidable leaders, wonderful people. And we will then have them come back into your tribe as members of the church, as leaders, and start to teach more people. You can send more people into Abidjan. And we can gradually build up the membership in the church. And if your tribe is what you're stating, that it's a wonderful experience and to be baptized into this church, then they can come in this way and we'll gradually work it up. You will have this high level of living with you." He looked at me in the face and he said, "That is the very reason that I want your church. You always come out with the right answer." He says, "I knew it was impossible for you to teach 16,000. But I knew that you, if you had the right church, you could come up with the right answer and you could indeed teach. And you did come up with the answer of how to do it." He says, "I am telling members everywhere I can, this is the true church. Every indication comes to me that way, and I will welcome you as a tribal brother." So we had experiences like this all the time, and it was very easy to find people to baptize. The problem was coming up with leadership. And that's why we turned down baptism after baptism, as you have heard, in order to come up and teach the leadership. It's been lovely talking to you. I imagine my time is up. And if any of you ever have a chance to go to Africa, it's a wonderful experience. The food, oh boy, is it good. You live in the tropics. You have all this tropical food. And I found the people just like they are here. Oh, there's differences like culture and color of skin and so forth. But it doesn't matter where you go in the church, you can find people the same with the same concepts. They want the same standards. They will live up to the same standards. They will want to become educated. And it doesn't matter where you go. Africa, we have these members that are built, that we're building up this base to. They're wonderful people that you can talk with, enjoy, and live up to the standards. They might even put some of us through shame because they are so sincere and they love it.
How did you come out with the 16,000, by the way? Did you baptize all those people?
I had the group of the 300 and the group of the 16,000, and then I have many, many other groups. I'd go to the pharmacy, and I'd walk in there, and I'd say, "Oh, you're American, tell me," and one thing would lead to another, and everybody in the pharmacy wanted to be baptized. And I'd go to the post office, and I'd start talking to them, and I'd walk in, "Hey, there's that American, hurrah, come on in, hey, we want to be baptized." I mean, everywhere I went, I ran into that. And I could have baptized thousands and thousands and thousands, and I went back to our mission president, and I says, "Look, what do I do?" And he says, "Turn as many as you can over to the missionaries." And so we started out with 16 or 17 missionaries when we got there. When we ended, there were 60. And we were just turning all these people over to them, and they would come back and say, "More people to teach?" And they had a hard time to keep up with it because there were so many people to teach and so many people that wanted the church. And so the way it ended, I just put them all on the standby list and said, "Talk to the missionaries and see if you can get on a standby list to be taught." And we backdated for 2 and 3 months the baptisms. Okay. Did I answer it? Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you. I certainly would like to thank those who participated on the panel. I felt like if you get to know them, I think that the messenger is the message in this case. In each case, you have found individuals who are dedicated to doing the will of our Father in heaven. In each case, you find people who love their fellow men, who recognize that each person is a person of worth, dignity, and integrity. You find people who believe that each person is our brother and sister, and that we're all children of our Father in heaven. This is the one thing that is common, I think, with all of us, irrespective of the mission in which we fulfilled. Like Cindy, when we were in Romania, we were not able to wear our name tags, nor were we to preach the gospel. In fact, President Nunswander, who is our regional representative, told us that our mission was to be pure, that we were to provide humanitarian service with no underlying reason other than to love and to be of service. That's not to say that the humanitarian service missionaries do not set good examples, and because of their examples, others become interested and want to know of the church. But in our cases, what we do is just refer them to the young missionaries. And we felt like that we had the cream of the crop, but I'm sure you felt that way as well. At this time, is there anyone else within the audience who would like to share their experience as a missionary, a senior missionary, or if you have any questions or comments? Yes.
How well did you learn Romanian?
In my case, I didn't. It's true, I went to the MTC to learn Romanian, but I was not able to hear all of the words. And when I came back to the States, I found I'd lost 70% of my hearing. So now I have hearing aids, and now I hear about 92% of what people say. But the things that I was able, I was not able to hear the consonants in words. Most of the people that we worked with do speak very good English. And in our case, we worked mostly with psychologists and psychiatrists. In fact, we had 300 psychiatrists that we were working with at the mental hospital. And one of the things that we were able to do This also was, we gave talks on an international, on a national basis with international participation. And when we weren't able to talk, when we had people who did not speak English, we had translators. Lou? I don't think that it would have made any much difference. And the reason that I say that is because in most cases they didn't know what we represented. They didn't know who or what institution we even represented. We did not tell them unless they asked us. And if they asked us, of course we'd say we represent the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then if they were interested in knowing about the church, we just told them about our young missionaries, and it was their responsibility to teach. And if they'd like to know, we'd be glad to make a referral to them. In one case, I was traveling on the train from Bucharest to Ploiești, and a fellow was sitting there on the train, and he got up and he came back and he sat down across from us and he asked us what we were doing, and we told him that we were this is how we'd answer in the beginning, that we were humanitarian service missionaries. And he says, "And what is your background and what do you do over here?" Well, in my case, I was a psychologist, but also a special educator. And my wife was a librarian, and so she helped in working in libraries. And then he says, "What are you going to Ploiești for?" And he says, "Well, we're going to church." "Well, don't they have a Mormon church?" And we, of course, we had told him who we represented also. He said, "Don't they have a church in Bucharest?" And we said, "Yes. But we have been assigned to Ploiești to go each Sunday," which was 37 miles on a train. And their trains, and I'm sure that the others can testify to this, the windows are usually open, and when it's winter, it's cold, and it's freezing. And when you go to church, you go in with your overcoat on, and your boots, and your hat, and you keep them on all through the service because you are freezing to death. But we told him that we were going to attend an LDS meeting, and he says, "Well, I'm going to go to Ploiești," and he says, "I have a daughter there." He says, "Can I?" And then he asked us, he says, "Well, what do you believe?" And we says, "That's not our responsibility to teach you what we believe." And he says, "Were you ashamed of what you believe?" And we says, "No. But we're here as humanitarian service missionaries, and we're not to in any way use our position as humanitarian service missionaries to push the church." And he said, "Well, do you care if I come to your church meeting then?" And he said, "No." And so he came to the meeting, and the missionaries, of course, met with him, and they felt like he was definitely a golden contact. And he told everybody, he says, that guy, he's quite a psychologist. He got me so interested in knowing something about your church. I'm here. Will you please tell me about your church?" And like you, we were also invited at one time. Dr. Anka of the Central Education Library, he says, "I'll get you 2,000 people. They're all scientists." And he says, "And I want you to tell them about your church." He says, "I'm sorry, we can't do that." And I was telling my mission president about this, President Wild, later, and he says, "He would have given you all 2,000 people to talk to?" And I says, "Yes." And he says, "What did you say?" And I says, "We can't do that." And he says, "Whew, thank God." And, but anyway, definitely in the third world countries, you cannot use, as a humanitarian service missionaries, you cannot use your church as a way to try to convert other people. Even the young missionaries are not able to go proselyting. They have street meetings, and then, of course, when they're invited into the homes, that's when they can teach. They cannot go up and knock on a door. And then even after a person joins the church, like you have home teachers and visiting teachers, here they are, members of the church. But you cannot go and knock on their doors and say, "I'm your home teacher, I'm your visiting teacher." They definitely still have a distrust of people who come up and knock on their door. And in Romania, some of the homes still, you know, are bugged. And even though they're trying to change from a communistic country to a more of a democratic form of government, the people who hold positions in government are still exactly the same people that were there under communism. And, of course, they do things the way that they're comfortable of doing things. And so they still have to be educated. But at the same time, you have kind of a middle kind of class of people who are trying to really make a difference. But they do have the freedom of speech, and the people really tell the higher officials exactly what they think, and nothing happens to them. But a few years ago, if an American were to go into Romania and talk to, and if a Romanian allowed himself or herself to talk to the American, they could be killed for talking to an American. And so things definitely have changed. When we went there was about 100 members, and now there's around 600 members, and of course the mission's only about 3 years old. Yes. Would you come here so people can hear?
You'll all relate to this leadership problem. Every mission has it. But the elders went to one branch, and they found the sisters passing the sacrament. And they waited until the meeting was over and very carefully explained that this was a function of the priesthood and it must not take place again. And they waited a couple of weeks and went back, and the sisters were still passing the sacrament. And so they got a little irate, and they said, "Didn't you understand when we talked to you last time about this, that this is a function of the priesthood?" And the branch president smiled, and he said, "No problem. We gave it to them yesterday."
Wish to go on a proselyting mission, but did wish to go on a mission and to serve the church in some meaningful way. Apparently, you don't get young people.
Our daughter was a welfare missionary in the Philippines.
And how old was she?
She was 19, 21.
Okay. Okay, welfare services mission, it sounds like that you can.
Her daughter helped write the welfare lessons as used all over the church. It was her ministry.
Okay. Yes.
You mentioned that in your background you had some questions or had some doubts or whatever. And I wondered if you run into any problems with the church leadership over that. You had a my state presence that anyone with any questions concerning any policy or program in the church can't have any position of teaching.
Yeah, that's a good question. Our stake president, when like I was saying, I was a member of the High Council, and when I was actually interviewed by him, I told him, I says, "You've got to know something about me." You know, and we were already friends, but I still had not shared some of my questions. And I says, "You've got to know that I don't have a traditional testimony of the gospel." I says, "My testimony of the gospel is that I love the Lord, I love God with all of my heart, my mind, and strength. My testimony is that I wish to be of service, but in my case, I'm not the kind of person who can say that he knows without any question." And I says, "So if this is going to block my call as a missionary, you need to really know this." And he says, "Well, I think in your case it sounds like that you're saying you can't say you know unless you know scientifically." And I said, "That's about right." And he says, "I have no problem with that." And, you know, and like when I've gone for a temple interview, like, for example, they'd say, "Are you honest?" And I'd say, "Generally speaking, yes." And they'd say, "What do you mean, generally speaking? You know, honesty is like pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not pregnant." And I said, "Well, I must be fully pregnant then." And he says, "Well, will you tell me what you mean by that you're generally honest?" I says, "Well, it's not what I say that's dishonest. It's the things that I don't say." And this was before the Negroes were able to hold the priesthood, and I gave this as an example. I says, "I don't feel like that the were justified as a church to withhold the priesthood from the Negro. I said, but I go to priesthood meeting, and I don't say anything, and I feel that I'm not being true to myself because I don't even tell people what I actually believe or feel. And so it's what I don't say. It's not what I'm saying. And he says, well, I'm sure glad that you keep your mouth shut. And then another case, they were asking me, well, do you sustain the president of the church as prophet, seer, and revelator? And I says, I sustain him as definitely as the prophet, seer, and revelator of the church on pragmatic grounds. And he says, what do you mean, pragmatic grounds? I says, well, he's the president of the church, so he's the only one who can speak for the church. And he says, I think maybe I ought to be interviewing you for excommunication. And I says, if that's how you feel, and if you feel prompted, then I think you ought to do exactly that. You know, because you have to also be honest with your calling. And it took 3 hours for this interview with me. And then at the end he says, you know, if the church can't take honest people, I don't know what they can take. And he says, and so I'm going to give you a temple recommend, but I don't know why. He says, but you're so honest and you're so open with me. And I think a lot of it depends on who the bishop is and who the stake president is. In my particular case, I was accepted.
I'd like to point out that I learned one thing that was very different when I was there. And that is that everybody hears about Africa and they wonder, are the blacks, are the people over there, how can they be of the house of Israel? And we had that answered to us. We've got a temple now in Johannesburg and Berlin, in Germany. And we've got people from Africa going to the temple and coming back, and they're having patriarchal blessings given to them. And when we were there, we asked them, what did the patriarchal blessing tell you about your ancestry? What's your lineage? This is the part that I thought was interesting. They came back, some, we are from the tribe of Joseph. Another one, we are the tribe of, what was the other one? Dan. Another one, we are the tribe of Asher. Another one, we are from the tribe of Gad. Now this has opened up a new perspective to me. Where are the 12 tribes? I don't know. But patriarchal blessings are showing that many of them are coming forth out of Africa.
This is just Horman doctrine, but I firmly believe that it didn't take this long for the Negroes to be worthy of the priesthood. I think it took this long for us to be worthy.